On this week's podcast, we are going to be digging into the numbers section, the meat and potatoes of the syndication LPE course. And we're going to be going into things like reversion cap rate, what is full occupancy, basically a lot of the stuff that you should know as a passive investor. Now, you're not going to be an underwriting specialist or have access to CoStar or Yardi. For some of those screenshots of what we have access to as operators, we'll put it into the e-course so you can see what we see. But what we want to get you guys on today's podcast is up to a decent level of understanding so you understand a little bit of the numbers. Now, the whole reason of this is things are starting to move now, right? We're starting to see this recovery and growth. The U.S. single family home market is showing signs of recovery. Single unit housing starts are increasing by 7.8% annually and 27% quarterly. This positive trend is expected to continue and growth forecasted for 2024 to 2026. If you think I'm making this stuff up, I'll put the link so you can read the article yourself in this week's newsletter. Interest rates and mortgage payments. Now, it may not be this summer, but at some point, interest rates are going to be coming down and anticipated to decline even further. I've got a cool chart of what the projections are looking like in comparison to what's happening in the EU and Asia. So there's going to be that pivot point, and what you want to be is in an asset already, because we see it all the time as sellers, right? Whenever that tide turns, we're going to start to command much, much better pricing. So if you're somebody who thinks you're going to wait for interest rates to start coming down and then get back into the game, you're going to miss that juicy bounce off the bottom. And then this is the big one. A lot of us forgot about inflation, but inflation is going to come back like a mother the next few years. I see it coming back maybe even to 5, 10% plus. Now, as I was discussing with other investors here this past week, the CPI looks like it's pretty sticky at 3%. But expect this to decline very sharply here. And that is because there is a lag on how rent increases impact the CPI, because tenants typically sign one-year leases. We know this very well ourselves as real estate investors. But this data in the sector is added into the CPI a very silly way. The real data from the multifamily real estate sector indicates that rent increases are not occurring as previously measured. This flat rent growth is expected to lead to a lower CPI. With a predicted lower CPI, the Federal Reserve may cut rates to prevent deflation, which is traditionally a significant concern for the Fed as opposed to inflation. Wall Street Journal also reported that those who are first to move in are going to get most of the spoils. We'll put that link in the newsletter for you, in addition to what's coming up in the next deal. And just a heads up, my book has released. You can go check it out on Amazon, The Wealth Elevator. Do me a favor, buy the e-version and give me a nice review there. I really appreciate it. And if you guys are part of the newsletter, I'll put another free chapter for you guys to check out in there. This podcast is going to be a little bit more in-depth. Might be one that you check out on the YouTube channel because there will be extra visuals there. But enjoy the show. And remember, if you're not a part of our investment club, you're not getting access to the full e-course where you get all these videos and written out blurbs on all these little concepts that we're talking about here today. To get that, go to thewealthelevator.com/club, sign up there. It's free and you get access to all this cool stuff. Welcome, folks. This is the part four of the Passive Investor Due Diligence e-course. Last time we only got through about halfway, so we're picking up the other half. Discussing about cap rates. This is different than what the properties are performing at. This is what is the prevailing market rate for a particular asset. And obviously they'll range from here. Here, scrolling across the screen is a garden style apartment, for example. Could be class A, B, C, big range, but that's why there's a big range between 4% to 7%. Obviously in the last, year, the cap rates have gone up, meaning that you get less dollar for NOI or prices have come down. So the question is always, when is it a good time to buy? Now, most times you have this very consistent spread between the cap rates, what does the property produce as an investment versus the average 10-year treasury, which is indicative of where the borrowing rates are. So coming up till 2020, you had this situation where the cap rates and the interest rates were in a declining fashion. Now, I don't know where we're heading after 2023 and beyond, some people say we're in this state where interest rates may stay pretty elevated. Some people even say you're going to see a double peak in inflation. Some people even say that you'll see the rise of the US stablecoin dollar as it comes to save the day and then can control everything that we do. You're one of those people. I think you guys love those conspiracy theories. But anyway, as far as investments goes, these cap rates, they float up and down with the interest rates. And it's always a good time to be buying as long as there's a spread. The thing about real estate is you really need to have good leverage in there to be able to magnify the returns. The interest rates really need to be there. But if you look at this graph, the ideal times to buy are when the spreads are bigger. So when you apply leverage, then you're able to make a nicer return there. Easier said than done. It's almost impossible to pick those peaks and not invest in these kind of squeeze points here. Like 2000, and I was investing during that time in 2016, early 17. And yeah, that did feel like a squeeze point for sure. You never know. And I think this is all like macroeconomics. Like you need to look into really what is the investment in the macro or the sub market. And then the particular deal you're investing in, then to look at real high level stuff. But this is an academic course. Here's that same premise that I was talking about earlier. You see the kind of the spreads in interest rates versus the cap rates in relation to where they are historically. Multifamily, you can see the trend where, again, the last couple of decades, the cap rates coming down. Now, is there a correlation to interest rates? Yeah, probably. It's correlated. Think about it. You need to have the interest rates lower than what you're going to make on the asset. If not, nobody would buy the damn assets. Now, in some situations, you may have a reversal of it, but for the most part, people buy things when the cap rate is a little bit higher than what your borrowing rate is. So, example today, which if you guys are listening to this in the future, it's going to be one of those moments in time where it's, wow, you read about this in textbooks, right? Where the Fed jacked up interest rates 5.5%. Your borrowing rate is the Fed rate is like 5.5, right? Or maybe even six as the 10-year treasury. So your cap rate is going to sit right on top of that, which is why assets are trading for a lot higher, 2% more than what it was. So if you bought a 4% deal a couple years ago, today that's a six. And the industry average would be for multifamily apartments. Again, going back to, yeah, this would be a good chart to talk about that. Multifamily apartments, again, this is class ABC, so super general. Today, I would probably say it's in like the average eight would be my guess. Some of the markets will buy in. A class B asset will be sitting in the six range. This also includes class C stuff and even tertiary markets, those really rinky-dink small markets. So that's why I say it's probably eight today, which is why like the interest rates are right there. So you're always going to have people always ask, what are the cap rates? And I talked about this in the last video. Brokers know, but if you don't know any brokers, just what is the borrowing rate? What is the 10-year treasury? And that's like a good like bottom shelf of what the cap rates are from a high level. That's in a nutshell what an investor does, right? They take the cap rates and interest rates, they dance up and down with each other in tandem for the most part. Sure, there's squeeze points, but there's also wide points. You can't time the market, but they're investors. What you're doing is you're taking the spread. You're buying it for this, you're selling it for that in a way. And then you're applying leverage to magnify that delta. So over the last couple of decades, you've seen this phenomenon where cap rates have been going down, which means that the prices of properties have been going up. Now, in 2022, we saw an inflection point where you saw a quick decay of prices. Thus, cap rates went up to mimic or sit right on top of interest rates as interest rates shot up. So I would strongly say there is a correlation between interest rates and cap rates, which is the real estate prices. We're talking in huge generalities here. Cap rates range widely between different markets where your more stable, more desirable markets like San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, they're lower than your rinky-dink smaller markets. But this table here only has more of the secondary markets like San Antonio, Atlanta, Denver. You can see how they compare to the primary markets. And then probably some of the smaller markets like Waco, Texas, or small college town might be sitting in like the sixes or who knows, maybe even sevens. This is an older chart from 2021. So this was before the great Fed correction where everything went up by at least a point or two. And I say it again, like it's not about timing the market with cap rates or the spreads in terms of interest rates and cap rates. It's more about the best time to invest was yesterday, because really all this investing game is, if you're a calculus person, is the area between the two curves, right? That's where investors make their money and of course leverage. So the quicker you can get started benefiting from that delta, the more money you're going to make over time. It's not a get rich quick scheme. It's just something that you just have to keep plugging away at, and you got to keep put more money on the table to buy more assets and also to get diversification. I think we talked about in the last previous edition, but again, the cap rate indicates the rate of return. And this is that big formula where the value of the property is equal to the net operating income divided by the capitalization rate. The net operating income is in control by the operator, right? You increase income or decrease expenses. That's totally within your control, where the capitalization rate or the cap rate is fully outside of your control. That's dependent on what the market is trading at. When we had talked about cap rate gate, I do believe in the last edition, but since I think that this is probably one of the most important things in the whole e-course and one of the quickest ways to, from a high level, analyze the conservativeness of a deal, I'll go over this again. So what this is, one of the biggest pieces on the spreadsheet, the underwriting spreadsheet that you as the passive investor will never get, is what is the reversion cap rate of the deal? What is the operator assuming, or syndicator, whatever you want to call them, assuming that they're going to be selling? What market are they going to be selling it at, right? They're going to do value add, blah, blah, blah. They're going to increase the NOI 10, 20%, whatever. But you need to plug it into this equation. Right. The value of the property is the operating income divided by the cap rate. They need to figure out or take a wild ass guess on what this capitalization rate or cap rate is at the end of the deal, whether that's 1 year away, 3 years away, 5 years away. And if you guys are reading into what I'm saying, this reversion cap rate or exit cap rate means the same thing. I would say the reversion cap rate sounds cooler. It probably gets you into the underwriting clubs, because it makes you look like you know what you're talking about. That's a wild-ass guess. However, more professional conservative underwriters will use an exit cap rate of 0.5% to a full percent higher than the starting cap rate. Why? Because when you increase that cap rate, you're being more conservative. You're assuming you're selling it into a softer market. I see professional investing firms, what they'll do is they may even keep this reversion cap rate the same, or maybe even decrease it, assuming that they're selling it into a stronger market, which should get the hair on your neck going up. And they may also justify it, whether right or wrong, saying, hey, we're increasing the class of the building from a B-minus class to a B-plus class. Therefore, we've justified this. Maybe better be doing a hell of a lot of value at 20, 30 grand per unit, if that's the case. But why does this matter so much, right? So say you're a Boy Scout and you use increase of 1% of your reversion cap. Therefore, the spreadsheet says, hey, you're going to make 100% return 5 years. We just pinned it at that for just discussion's sake here. And what if their evil twin brother says, let's just tweak the numbers a little bit and change it to 0.25% increase in the reversion cap rate? Then his deal looks like it's 144% return in 5 years. So you can see how that just skewed the numbers by 30, 40% right there. So this is one of the biggest levers to fudge the numbers. And this is where I think new investors, they look at the pro forma returns and I would say, take it with a grain of salt, right? Like dig in a little bit. You don't need to do full on analysis. That's never in the scope of an LP. But this type of analysis is good to just look under the hood and see what's going on there. And to me, when I was first starting out, I would spot check this. And then I would dig into some of the other things that we're going to be talking about here.
later on, as this would be the indicator on which way things are going. So this would be if you're evaluating an Uber driver, right? And you show up, is this car all beat up? Is it smell like smoke, right? Ooh, that might be a sign that this Uber driver is not really responsible. Maybe I shouldn't get into this car. And then maybe you still got into this car because it's raining, but then you see this guy lighting up a cigarette and drinking a 40. That's more bad signs, right? And you should probably get out of that Uber car. What is going on with these cap rates for these types of properties? So this is just illustrating how in different markets and different asset and different classes of buildings, that higher end properties are always going to be a lower cap than others. We've liked Huntsville, Alabama for a long time because we think of it as like a darling tertiary market. It might even be a stronger secondary market these days. But these assets would trade for the high fives and sixes. Today's market, 2023, 24, I would say trading in the sixes and sevens. The danger, I think, on one hand, and I thought I made this mistake initially where I thought, yeah, let's just go after the higher caps, right? We're cash flow investors. At one time, we called the brand Simple Passive Cash Flow. We want cash flow, which is higher caps. But the hard thing about tertiary markets, and why I would say just try and stay away from them, not try to stay away from, but don't fall in love with tertiary markets, because there's a reason why the cap rates are really high. Where at one time, I was really against investing in Seattle, California. I'm against it for other reasons, like more political kind of stuff there. But New York, right? Like, I'm looking at stuff in New York because the cap rates are low, which because it's such a stable market, right? New York is always going to be New York. And there's this idea when in bad times, people always want to invest in class AAA plus markets. And I don't know if I've ever used that term before, but I've been talking about it within my circles. Class AAA market is, I think, a fake term, but it means like Manhattan, for example, right? New York City, that whole, the boroughs, that's considered a double A kind of market. But when you're talking about Manhattan, that part of New York City, that's considered AAA. And you never know. That's why you diversify. But I would probably bet my last dollar on New York still being New York and the powerhouse as it is. But you pay a lot for that, right? So there's always a trade-off. More different videos here talking about the reversion cap rate. It's very important. If there's one thing in this whole 10-hour e-course that you should understand, it's this reversion cap rate thing. And I think next we're going to transition to loan terms here. This has been very important these last couple of years. A lot of people, ourselves included, we played with some floating debt because we had to. The market got hit the top in 2021, 2022. And to even get deals to work and be competitive, you had to use more aggressive lending products. Now, you may be an investor who understands the risk for reward profile of this and have a diversified portfolio, and you may be able to lean into the strategy. But if you're a very conservative investor, maybe you don't want to go into any floating rate debt deals. And what floating rate debt deals are is your couple of things. It's your interest rates changes with the debt. So in a black swan event, 40 plus years, interest rates going from 0 to 5.5 in about a year, that's unprecedented. And most times, professional underwriters, you'll be able to absorb maybe a 2-3% increase. But when it goes to 4, 5, 5.5, that's when it breaks the models. And at some point, there's always a fudge factor, but if things get worse in those kinds of circumstances, it breaks deals. And if you would have had maybe fixed rate debt, you would have been fine. But again, everybody questions, why did these bozos get floating rate debt? If not, the deal wouldn't have worked in the beginning and nobody would have been investing. The deal would have showed maybe 50, 60% return in 5 years and nobody would have invested. Or the operator would have fudged numbers and gotten that magic number everybody wants to see. And LPs wouldn't be the wiser, right? Because they don't dig in after that first page. But now you guys are smarter. You guys know to look into that type of stuff. But as you can see, we're getting a little bit more complicated. And this is a bit of a cat and mouse thing between sponsors and passive investors. The sponsor is always going to try and promote the deal a little bit better. And they're in the business of marketing a deal. there's always going to be some of that, right? But LPs are trying to find the best deals written more conservatively of those that are available. So there are different types of bank loans here. The lending, the senior debt can be a bank, can be an insurance company, can be a debt fund. So it doesn't necessarily need to be a big banking institution that I think that we're all used to. Like, a lot of people like to invest in multifamily because it makes a lot of sense. I think that's why we're all here, right? It's housing or any types of residential properties, it makes sense. It always comes up, the infinite banking accredited investor policies that we put together for clients, that we also have the e-course in here for you guys too, that the insurance companies are very stable companies, more so than these banks. The banks do fractional reserve banking and it's more aggressive and more risk on their part, where the insurance companies can't really do that. But where do they go and to seek the alpha to pay out the distributions to their investors and pay out the policies? They will invest in multifamily real estate. That's again where that was one of the many reasons why I jumped into this business and following what this sophisticated institutional money does. Let's say traditional, like vanilla type of loan, you'll usually have some kind of term loan on it. So this is what this line is, typical term years. It can be a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 12. I've seen it as high as 15. Now, I think this is very important, or maybe this is just a personal thing that I kind of key in on. But anything less than 5 years, it's a little short because you're always going to have some kind of mini hiccup happen quite frequently. A black swan event where you restart a market cycle. And what I mean by market cycle is the textbooks say every 8 to 13 years, you have a full cycle on the sine curve where the market goes down and corrects back up. That is what you want to protect against. And you certainly want to protect against the mini sine curves, which I would say come every few years, which is why a 4 or 5 year loan term will bridge over that time horizon. And certainly a 7, 10 year would. You're never going to get these loans amortize over 30 years, which I think a lot of us are used to, but the loan terms, you're never going to get longer than 15 years. Nobody really gets that. Nobody really gets more than 12. 12 is considered as overkill because especially when you get into the nature of value add projects, you're going to pump the value, get in there for a couple years and then sell it, right? So anything 10, 12 years plus can be seen as you're just going to be paying more for your interest rate or your loan. So there's a sweet spot here. And that's where defending the floating debt and the shorter term bridge notes. With the bridge notes, you don't have these prepayment penalties, where with these more permanent financing, you have these kind of nasty prepayment penalties. If you're kind of these investors you always need to look at like things like there's a three sides to every coin. The long-term fixed rate debt deals seem good and conservative, and they are. Trade-off is the prepayment penalties, which can be 1% to a few percent points that's paid out. And that sounds small, but that could mean the difference between investors getting 100% return in 5 years versus 80% return in 5 years. When you look at it that way, you may not care, but that's a big chunk of your returns right there. The Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac are the agency financing. That's, you know, the government subsidized types of loan. And this is how the government subsidizes this types of workforce housing, which the country needs more and more of. It is non-recourse debt, but for passive investors, you guys don't really care. That just is on the loan guarantor's head. That kind of makes things a little bit more safer for the loan guarantors, also known as the key principals, the guys who sign on debt, put up their personal balance sheets. Some important things to know or be aware of, to qualify for the debt, you need to have Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac experience. So you need to have done a deal before, not like a little single family home or anything like that, but like 100, 200 unit property. So this is where it makes this business a big chicken and egg thing. And this is why you see a lot of new people have these huge sponsorship groups where people are just sitting on the loan to get that checkbox. The net worth of the sponsorship group needs to be greater than or equal to the loan amount. So if you're going after a $20 million, you need to have maybe a $10 million guy and another $5 million and another $5 million guy who signs on the balance sheet. When we're first starting, we're looking for KP guys. I guess we're always looking for guys who are looking to sign on debt. And that's what's going on there. And of course, they get compensated by that. Some would say if it's a good risk reward, because technically you're putting up your entire balance sheet. Some higher net worth investors over $5 million will like to play that, especially if they like and trust the operator. I would prefer maybe to play more on the earnest money, hard money side, where you put up money to close the deal. Because to get a deal, just like earnest money, you have to put down some money that goes hard. And if you don't close the deal, you lose it. So some people will like to help out the general partnership, put up 500 grand or whatever, and they get some points to the deal by doing that. Different, more exotic ways is people like to play. That's very uncommon, but it falls within this realm. And the other thing is like post-close liquidity. They want to see the sponsorship team having 10 to 20% of the loan amount. And as a passive investor, this is where you want your GP to be that backstop for you guys. We talked about earlier, like the 10% rule that investors like to see from their sponsors, which I think is a little dumb. I think that's more common for operators who've on their first several deals, but institutional operators, I think we're heading more in the future. And they're not rinky dink operators who've done less than $1 billion of assets. I don't think it's common that you see them put any money into the deal. And that's fine, right? They have the track record to be okay with that. But more importantly, what I care about more as an investor is if things go south, who's writing a $3, $4, $5 million check to bail us all out, as opposed to that capital coming from a capital call. I think that's more important than an operator having 500 grand of skin in the game. Again, three sides to the coin. Some people think that they need to have X amount in there. Some people think that they don't need it. And I'm like, depends on how much experience they have. And this is why community and talking to more experienced investors who do this many times and see the ups and downs is probably more important than reading this e-course, which is more black and white. We normally get in the situation where we're like, we look at the 15-year, 12-year. To me, that's a little too long. And again, you're paying a little bit more for the interest rate, and that just hurts your holding costs, kills your cash flow. And when most projects are value add anyway, and you're going to get out in 4 to 5 years, I think like a 7 or 10 year is good enough. It's that midway is my opinion today. Of course, I always learn things and can change my opinion. But right now, I think a 7 to 10 year loan is solid. And this is normal. Like normally the max loan, the value is 75-80%. But right now we're in an upside down world where interest rates are very high. Lending standards are very difficult. We're talking 2023. These have come down to 50%. Which is why we haven't really been doing a deal this past year. It'll come back to normal. I don't know if cap rates are going to come back down to where they were. I don't think interest rates are going to come back down to where they were. And I don't know if max loan to values are going to come back to where they were. But I do suspect within a couple of years, you'll start to see the loan to values come back up to 65, 75% again. And then the interest rates come back down to like maybe the 4% Fed rate. One thing I've seen people do lately, because the deals don't really pencil, is they change their underwriting from a 5-year hold to a 10-year hold, which most investments, it goes up like a hockey stick, right? Like just no different than your guys' net worth. You're going to get that nice boost more at the end. So if you show like a 5-year time horizon, you're not going to get that. You're not going to look as good on paper. So you can imagine why sponsors will like to use a 10-year hold, because it makes their numbers look a lot better and it gives them a lot more wiggle room. You see this with a lot of institutional operators who have a lot higher fee structures and they have a lot more carried interest. They take a lot more essentially, right, as sponsors, because I'll back them up. They deserve it, right? They have the track record experience and they also have the people on payroll. They got to feed mouths a lot more than your part-time multifamily operator who joined up a boot camp and is still working his IT job at the side. Institutional operators will take a lot more in sponsors compensation. And then to make up for it, they will do a 10-year hold, because also their investors are a little bit more sophisticated and long-term thinking. And they are a lot more thinking on a longer time horizon too. But I do see, sometimes I do call BS on this, because some people like talk about like infinite returns, which I think is BS, because all you're doing is you're refinancing and your return on investment is very low, like 10% a year. And they say that's because we still own the asset and it's unlimited returns because you took your initial investment out of it. I think they just use a 10-year hold and they just hold it forever. And this is where the way I like to look at deals personally is I like to run it like on a 5-year time horizon. and say, see, what is my runway? What is my return on investment in those 5 years to just like keep things consistent? And when you start to get into different asset classes, like your hold lengths could be a lot shorter or longer, but that's where you as an investor, unfortunately, need to compare apples and oranges and pears and compare them in a way on the same time horizon to compare them. And this is where some investors just don't have the mental capacity to be able to do this. And they just look at they're like, wow, 140% return in 10 years. And like, dude, I'd much rather take a 80% return in 5 years and then put my money in another 5-year project and then make way more. Part of this is just experience, seeing a bunch of deals and getting into a bunch of deals. And then you can tease out like the marketing nonsense that's done out there and like the tricks, like use a 10-year projection. Talked about bridge loans being a little bit more risky. With comes risk, comes reward. And ideally, the whole idea behind the Sharpe ratio is for every unit of risk, you should get the same unit of reward or maybe more. And if it's maybe more, you might be an investor where you want to take that asymmetric risk. Now, not all your investments are going to be the same risk reward profile. You may be an investor who takes 5% of your portfolio and puts it in Dogecoin, something that's super asymmetric, or a really risky multifamily value add in a tertiary market. Not saying that's risky in the whole grand scheme of things, but just saying in the world of real estate, that might be a little bit more pushing that envelope. If you want to take something from the higher net worth investors, a majority of their portfolio will be more conservative, but a very small portion will be the asymmetric growth, where as a totality of their portfolio, they're beating the industry average there. That said, if your net worth is under $5 or $10 million, you may not want to emulate what high net worth families do and disregard for now what I just said. And this is where like the construct of the wealth elevator comes into play. Everybody is on different stages of the wealth elevator. If your net worth is under $2 to $3 million, you got to get after it. You got to have a very high amount of alternative investments. And out of that, you may want to go into a lot of these more red type of Sharpe ratio types of deals. Whereas if you're already to end game, $4 or $5 million net worth, you may choose to play it a little bit differently. More into these green type of deals. And who knows, you may just choose to do a bunch of infinite banking. I don't know. So it depends on where your goals are at and where you are in the wealth elevator journey. And I think that's where this becomes very personal on what you're going into. And I think what people will do is they'll come to a retreat and start talking with investors. But the biggest thing that's missing, that I know where everybody's at, I know where everybody's net worth is. And I also can tell how people's ages are. Because sometimes you have older people who don't have very much money and you have younger people who are in their 40s who have a $4 or $5 million net worth. Like two very different places in the wealth building journey. And their portfolio of what kind of deals they go into and investments they pick are going to be very different. And unfortunately, even us, we don't have the culture of like when you meet somebody at one of our events, we don't have name tags of how much net worth you have and what your portfolio look like. So you could be hearing some input from somebody else on what their portfolio looks like, but you are likely not knowing what their net worth is. So we went over a couple of things, and this is more of a medium detail example. Here's a little bit like just like a sample deal. This is how we would look at it. All right, here's the summary. We got 140 unit apartment complex, class B minus C plus, old piece of crap here, 1967 vintage, $68,000 per unit. You're looking at the acquisition fees, asset management fees, which we talked about earlier, 3%. You looked at it up ahead and I've said it's 1% to 3%, sort of the industry normal for this, which could be totally justified if it's a very experienced operator who's done a lot of deals. But this particular case we're talking about is just some newbie, right? Who's done 5-6 deals. That would probably be standing out, right? That's the caps here, my coach's comments. Not to say that's a deal killer, right? Because it's all based on what else can you find, dude? It's like your friend who goes on online dating and says, yeah, none of these are working out. But then again, it's, dude, what else can you pull? Same thing like deal flow. Most people just go after the people who market well. And they have really high fee structures because they're just lazy. They don't know anybody and they just click on Facebook ads, stuff like that. These guys might have their in-house property management company. Sometimes that can be misleading. It can be a lie. It can just be a pseudo in-house property management company. But I think for a passive investor, you know, I don't know if you would have the expertise to tease that out. That's why I'm an operator. I know all the tricks of the trade here. And then the big one is like, all right, what's in it for me? What's the projected returns? Not saying that they hit this, but like at least where's the set point? Okay, they're going to 15% IRR. All right, that's not bad. Equity multiplier of almost 2 and 5 years. That's the way I look at the deals. Like I said, I look at them on a 5-year time horizon. So it's like for those of you guys who like cars, that's like looking at cars and saying to your buddy, what's your 0 to 60?
Let's say 4.5 seconds. Nobody says, what's your 0 to 85 miles per hour?
Maybe you have a Tesla, you do that. Everybody says, what's your 0 to 60? And then same kind of thing here. I'm always, in 5 years, what am I going to get? What's my equity multiplier? With 2.0 being 100% return 5 years. I think 1.85, I think that's like a 90% return in 5 years. Close enough, right? Because we've gone in the section, you guys see how much the numbers get fudged. Do not disqualify a deal because their stated returns are 10 to 20% less than what you're looking for, because you're looking for that 110% return in 5 years. That is super newbie. Do not do that. What you really want to do is at least go through these set of assumptions. I'm spot checking and I'm like, all right, I noticed that they're assuming that the rents are going to go up 10% in their first year, which could be valid. Maybe the rents are really low. That this could be very valid. And I think this is where some investors, passive investors may dig into this. If you're seeing like a 20% rent increase, that shit ain't happening, guys. And that can be a red flag. Next thing here, 3% market rent increases after the first year. So this is what's called the annual escalator. Normally, you'll see people using a 1 to 3% rent escalator. I always like to play it a little conservative and use at most a 2%, even in strong markets like a Dallas, where you have generally decent growth, and 3% might be a little high. And I think you may look at it as just 1%, but when you do the sensitivity analysis, as I have, like how we did here, if you moved it from 3% to 2%, your projected returns at the end of the day may change 10 to 20%. So that, again, that's why I said, just because a deal is showing 85% return in 5 years and it's not showing that 100% that you want, do not disqualify the deal until you start to tease out some of these assumptions that are used underneath the hood. Usually in combo with the rent increases per year or the income increases per year is the expense growing. And these two are really to account for not bumping the rents up after rehab or after make readies, just inflation. Right, because rents go up typically on a long time horizon. They don't on a 1 to 3 time yield. It's up and down. Sometimes it goes really up. Sometimes it stays pretty stagnant or go down negative a little bit. But these are just mainly to take inflation into account. So inflation is what, typically 2 to 3%. I still like to use percent as a baseline. But in this case, since they use a 3% increases in income, I might want to see a 3% increase in expenses just to match it, because what they have here is a spreading delta on the which will show the deal is stronger than it really is. Does it matter too much? I think we're splitting hairs here, but it's just good to take note of it. Maybe they have some kind of story, right? And I think that's where a follow-up question may be like, why did you not just use 3% here? And they may say, We're installing new fiber optics or solar, so we figure we could save 40 grand a year on expenses. And that's how we accounted for this. All right. Fair enough. Good answer. The next one is like the vacancy, which is just the physical occupancy vacancy. Obviously, you want to add on top of that economic vacancy, which is deadbeats not paying, which is usually about 2 to 3% on top of this. But this is a tricky part. They're never going to give you one or the other. It's inconsistent. It's either going to be vacancy or economic vacancy, which includes your deadbeats not paying. So normally it depends on the market, right? Like I think you want to see at least a 6% vacancy, and then we add on a couple percent points for the economic vacancy. Now, depends on what asset class. If it's class A, you're going to see a little bit lower vacancy. If you have class C tenants, you're going to see a little bit more vacancy, maybe even 8%, and maybe even add on 3% delinquency on top of that. Delinquency is a big thing in class C. I mean, this is why we don't want to really do that anymore, because sometimes like we'll have 80% of the people pay. If you had 100% occupied property, your economic occupancy is 80% because 20% are deadbeats. I'm not going to go into loss to lease. This is more of a technical term. You guys can chat GPT what the heck that is. But I would say these are like the bigger ones to kind of be aware of. And then, of course, the biggest one of all is what we talked about earlier is, all right, what is the prevailing cap rate? What are these assets trading at today? Not what the property cap rate is. Two totally separate things. And I think this section talks about that three times, but I just want to make that very clear. And then how is it in comparison to the prevailing market, right? Obviously, you want to see that reversion cap rate higher than the prevailing market so you can be safe. And you can also see a big windfall. Like we've seen it where we bought like a property at like a 5.5 cap and then the was getting better and it went down to a 5 cap from a 5.5 to 5, which means we blew the projections out of water. I think we had 140% return in like under 3 years on that. And yeah, we're value adding, doing what we're supposed to do, bumping the NOI, but portion of that was just market appreciation, which comes and goes. But ideally, you try to be in the game when you're in ascending market. But you never know when the music is going to stop, right? If you play craps, you never know when that seven's coming out. And that's why you diversify. And on top of diversifying, that's the reason maybe you may want, if you're a conservative investor, again, that's why you play the game with longer loan terms and fixed rate debt. So if the seven comes out or there's a market correction, you can just stick your head in the sand and just hold on and just wait for that market to correct 4, 5, 6, 7 years later. Here are some points that new people will make. This is only a 1% rent to value deal. No bueno. It's not just the rent to value ratios in these apartments. There's other income. And it's also a game of, I do think rent to value ratios are going to be coming down generally over the years. We may even get to a point where we're like Europe, where the rent to value ratios are just horrible and there's not really too much lending. And that may be the end of any type of cash flow in any types of deals. So now it becomes like a game of purely value add. How much can you get the net operating income up and then selling it and just harvesting those capital gains, not cash flow? That would be sad. I think that's where we are heading. So like an investor may say, yeah, I don't like them using the 3% rent increases. It seems 2% for this market is better. Yeah, fair enough. But you know, take it all with a grain of salt. And I think this is hard for investors who never really played around with the underwriting spreadsheet. I'll tell you, it doesn't really move the needle too much in comparison to that reversion cap rate, which I did give you the sensitivity analysis on that. Sometimes you can ask your operator, especially if they're under $1 billion of deals, because they're desperate for money anyway, and you're going to be asking them a lot of annoying questions. Most good sponsors would probably just not want you to invest, I think, at that point. But I think if you ask questions very professionally and you don't ask more than a handful of questions, and you could say, hey, I was just curious, if you ran the rent increases at 2%, what would the projected returns be? And then you can, from there, start to build your own sensitivity analysis on how these things impact the projection at the end. But my feeling is, if somebody was using a 3% market rent increases per year, and they normalize it to 2%, like assuming this is 100% return in 5 years and you normalize it to 2%, I think it might go down to like 85, 90% return in 5 years. Not much. And that's why I say 10, 20% projection is a fudge factor. One little tweak on one of these things is going to move the needle a different direction on that. These are not deal killers, right? But these are, I think these are astute findings that one can say. Again, it's all what's best that you can find out there. People will invest, not invest in deals because acquisition fees are very high. I think that's silly, especially if you're working with the operator who has a few billion dollars assets in their ownership. You can pretty much assure your acquisition fees are going to be 3%. I, on the other hand, when it starts to get to 5, 6, 7% acquisition fees, that's a little high in my opinion. But they'll try and hide it. They'll say 3% acquisition fee, 1% funding fee, 1.5% capital fee, 2% clown fee. Like they'll add it up to, and they won't call it an acquisition fee, but it's all in the beginning. So it's all pretty much acquisition fee is the way that is the game. But hey, they're the ones doing all the work, right? There's a trade-off between reliability and costs. A big thing is I just don't want to invest with people under $1 billion of assets. I just see so many of these like real estate groupie kind of groups and just people who are just unproven. And I think that's why I come back to real estate. I've been looking at venture capital type of stuff. Real estate, it can run itself and there's great tax benefits. Whereas like really all you got to tease out is the people. Working with honest people, I put the most emphasis on that. And maybe that's just because I've been burned before, right? Like I've had previous partners that steal money and then I had to remove them from the GP, run the deal. And that just makes me get nightmares again going through that. So one thing we said earlier was like the rent increases per year. Most times they're not going to give you what those annual escalators are. You're going to have to just do a little math to figure that out. So to do that, you just take this year two minus year one, get the delta and then divide it by that and just make sure that it's consistent all the way around to get that percent increase. Super simple math. You don't need to be an engineer to do that. And same thing with vacancy. You know, again, like these projections are never shown the same way. But in this one, you would take the vacancy and you take this 31,000 divided by the gross potential rent, and there's your percentage right there. Projected returns. The way we do it is I always like to, like all these things, most LPs don't really care about. They shouldn't. I think of these real estate deals as a partnership. And if we don't want to work with each other next time, that's fine. We walk, right? And I see it as, at the essence, a handshake between a couple gentlemen or a lady saying that, hey, here's where we're thinking we can get these types of returns. We could do better. We could do worse. And this is what we think is going to happen. And just using a sample investment of $100,000 because it's a nice round number, this is how we think the game will play out. If we don't hit it, then there should be some reasonable expectations why it didn't happen. But then I would say, then you have the ability to not work with the people again, right? And you're diversifying over multiple people and you're really just going at it. And some people put a lot of emphasis on it. And I think if anything, we've teased out how much these numbers can fluctuate and market things can change, right? For example, what we've seen these last couple of years is taxes double, triple. And that's on this line item of expenses, right? Like property taxes triple. If they triple, you can see how it impacts the whole thing. Your net operating income pretty much goes down by half. And if you were projected a 7.3% cash on cash return your first year, that stuff went down by half, just on one line item, right? So you can see the fluctuations in this. And if you're uncomfortable with that, maybe stick to traditional investments, I'd say, but we all know it's going to happen there. One thing to be on the lookout for is deals showing a cash out refinance in year three. Depends on what the project is. If it truly is a more of aggressive turn and you're going to refinance in year two or three, and then show a refinance in year three. When we first started to do this, we would run things on a five-year time horizon and to show the very conservative outlook, which is we just hold it all the way to year five and sell. Even though we very well, maybe 80% of the time, we refinance year three and have a big windfall and the returns would be a lot higher. So that kind of alludes to like, hey, these projections, are these the target, optimistic or pessimistic? And that's what you're never going to really understand, right? I think the operator gets themselves into trouble as soon as they start to paint optimistic, pessimistic, because it starts to give ranges. And there's some legalities that go into it too, which I'm sure is frustrating on the passive investor side. But some operators don't even do any types of these types of projections and returns. It's just, hey, here's the business plan. You see you were bumping the NOI. Are you on board or not? If you don't have the level of sophistication to figure out if this is a good deal, you probably shouldn't invest in the first place. Sometimes though, those are the good deals to invest in. What's I think a lot of investors like to do is the break-even point. They want to know, all right, how is this deal going to fail? And at what point is it going to where I lose money, right? So the common levers that people like to place scenarios on is like, how low does the occupancy need to go for us to be cash flow negative on this deal? So what will be required is like to play around, like dropping these cells of the spreadsheet down to a certain percentage to start to see your debt service coverage ratio hit zero or your negative cash flow. This is the exercise that will be done in a break-even analysis. Another thing that people like to play around with is, as I said earlier, like that reversion cap rate is a big portion on that line item. So people will like to play around with that reversion cap rate, which is right here on the cell of the spreadsheet. See how so inconspicuous this line is, right? Reversion cap rate buried on the bottom left here. So we might say, you guys bought it at a 5.5 cap market and you're using a 6. Let's just be super conservative and let's throw 6.5 in here and let's see how that changes the numbers. I guess in recent, I think we would say, let's see what happens if the interest rates go up and if you have a floating rate debt deal, at what point will the debt service, how long will that eat into your expenses, right? These are all, that's a lot more technical, more much, much advanced type of scenario playing that probably goes beyond the scope of LPs, but that's what this break-even point analysis is. Thing is, you know, you can spot check the numbers. This is what I did initially when I was looking at deals. Like I have rough guidelines or ranges, like expenses per year per unit, for example. Inflation happened, right? So maybe $5,000-$6,000 of expenses per unit per year is a good range. If you see it like in the $3,000 range, that should be a huge red flag. I would say this is probably not within the range of passive investor due diligence, but I just throw this in here just so you can understand the limits of LP due diligence. Today, like I'll hire like a professional underwriter to help guide me and just spot check on what I know. And I would say it's similar to, we teach you guys a lot of with taxes, like how to interact with CPAs to ask the right questions, grouping election, rep status. Make no mistake, you're not doing the tax forms and the CPA should know this stuff. You're just guiding them. In a way, I think that's what I'd like for my students is just to understand this stuff and be able to walk through a pitch deck, maybe identify this stuff. Most times you're never going to get this type of information. But if you were to hire a third-party underwriter and they were to give you a professional report, you would be able to understand that report and then maybe ask a couple of good questions there. Like your numbers, some other terms here. Even we reached the top of the hour, the next lesson will be the LP checklist that will go next month. And I don't know if we're going to be doing it next time. We have the retreat. We'll see where that falls. That checklist takes this stuff all into account. And I also have some weighted averages. Some people get really inundated and like, oh, reversion cap rate is important, but they're using 3% annual escalators in their rents. How dare they? Guys, here's, I weighted them out. This is relatively unimportant, right, in the grand scheme of things. But that's what I struggle with distributing this information out is, what is the ranking of importance and magnitude of some of these types of things we discussed today? What I would recommend on this too is if you have a study buddy that really helps to go through this. This is a very dry section, I would say. I do think it's very important being more a numbers-based engineer guy, but I always use this section first. Then I would go into the people. The problem is with people is you never know who they are. And I think that's where knowing other purely passive investors who actually invest in this stuff is really more important, which is why people join our inner circle, the family office, Ohana group, because I think a lot of people these days are just like marketers and they should be, right? They should be putting their best face out there. And that's what we try to do too. But as far as like numbers don't lie, people do. And if you are able to spot check things a little bit as we've done here in these last couple of videos, then if you've gone through these four sections, you probably know more than most accredited investors out there. So have the confidence that you're ready to get out there. Of course, there's always risk. And I would say the big risk is with people. When I first started, 1 out of 5 deals I invested in were with kind of shysters or fake it till you make it kind of people. Some people think that's unacceptable. 1 out of 5 is not the majority, but it is what it is. And that's where now you see why, especially when you're starting out, it might make sense to work with more of a bigger operator that side. But all right, guys, have a good holiday. Bye.